Well, I think, you know, transgender people are in a curious situation internationally. It seems like the more things get better for us, the worse they get at the same time, because the world's never had so many visible trans people in popular culture, in the media, and now in politics. And you can see also quite significant over the last decade, quite significant improvements in public attitudes around transgender people. So, for example, a recent Australian survey of 54,000 people in Australia last year found that 45% agreed that there are more than two genders and just 38% disagreed. But on the other hand, trans people have become a favoured punching bag of right-wing politicians the world over. And we only have to look at places like Hungary, Poland and Russia, where there's quite an extreme, backlash against LGBT people in general, which is part of a broader far-right offensive. But looking as well at places like Britain, the United States, and even here in Australia, we see that elements of the conservative right very much see attacking trans people as an essential part of building a new culture war, a new form of right-wing politics that is about dragging us back decades and decades. So in Britain, there has been the quashing of the Gender Reform Act, Gender Recognition Act, which would have made it a lot easier for trans people to have their real gender, written down in documentation, and also an appalling decision made by the High Court recently in which they've made it even harder for young people under the age of 18 to access puberty blockers. And in the United States, although Donald Trump is now out, and a couple of his worst excesses have been reversed, at the state level, there is a constant legislative battle in every state to restrict the right of trans people to engage in the sport, go to the bathroom, accessing healthcare, and so on. And in Australia, we are not exempt from this. Recently, there was a conference in Brisbane called the Church and State Conference, in which some of the most unsavoury characters in Australia, including convicted fucking pedophile George Pell, tried to claim that we are the threat to the new generation. And, the director of the Australian Christian Lobby, who was there, spoke at length about what he called the transgender thing, describing it as the weakest part of the LGBTI rights movement because it was, quote, where the lie is most fragile. So they very much see this as the foot in the door. And obviously, when we look broader than that, we look at the statistics for the quality of life for transgender people around the world, and it's still appalling. You know, twice, three times as likely to be unemployed, to deal with extreme mental health problems, homelessness, poverty, substance abuse, and so on. These are not, it's not real progress if we look at those stats and see that nothing is really shifting there. Now, what is this lie, this fragile lie that he is talking about? Well, he is trying to claim that transgender politics is based on a lie because don't we all know that men and women are just biologically hardwired to be different? Whether it's the idea that, the ability to bear children somehow relates to all of the gender stereotypes that go on, the ideas that our hormones and our brains are all so different, that we're just naturally, better at sport or art or all that bullshit. That these are all basically fundamentally rooted in biology. It's always been that way, always will be that way. We're the ones subverting the course of nature. Going along with this is the idea also that homophobia and transphobia are natural because, that's just people going with the course of nature. Well, that's completely rubbish because what we see throughout history is that gender stereotypes massively differ based on the type of society you're in. So today, the toys that boys and girls are given are just overwhelmingly, gendered. And even before people are born, there are gender reveal parties. Everyone's obsessed with the genitalia of a baby that is not even in the world yet. And, you know, the idea that their whole life, so much of their life is predetermined by that fact. And yet, even 100 years ago, when definitely it's not like there was gender liberation of any kind, this is what boys and girls look like. So one of these is Eleanor Roosevelt, and the other is her husband, Franklin D. Roosevelt. So the one on the left is Franklin D. Roosevelt, and the one on the right is Eleanor Roosevelt. No, just kidding, it's the other way around. It would be the other way around. Actually, you know, children look the same. Before puberty, there are actually no differences, and yet we in our society are obsessed with creating secondary sex characteristics for children before they even have them. So what is really behind gender is that it's a social construction, by which we mean it is something that depends on the society you're in. Now, you know, before we go through all of that, what is the Marxist position on transphobia? Well, Marxists are absolutely in principle against all forms of oppression. We're against everything that narrows humanity, that restricts humanity, that deprives people of their freedom. And that means we're disgusted by transphobia. We are for people expressing their individual selves however they see fit, whatever labels they wish, for people to use each other's preferred pronouns. We demand that governments, businesses, respect that in all forms of documentation, wherever it even is necessary to put markers, sex markers and so on. We're for all medical forms of transitioning to be completely free and more accessible and available to young people. We demand, you know, tough anti-discrimination legislation. We're for educating people in schools about this. We're for allowing people to access whatever service, if there are sex segregated services in society, like bathrooms, gyms, sporting clubs, and so on. We're for people choosing the one that makes them more comfortable. So that is our starting point, but we need to understand why we don't live in a world where people are free for those things. And actually, we can go even beyond all of this. Now, for as long as gender has existed, actually, what the historical record shows is that there's always been people who deviate from that norm, because pretty much all of us do in one way or another. You know, in our society, if we think of everything we associate with the categories of man and woman, your family roles, your jobs, your social interactions, your physical appearance, your sexual roles, these are the most obvious. But even our pastimes, our artistic and sporting preferences, our fashion, our ways of thinking and speaking, even the food and drink we consume are gendered, are, you know, considered to be, have some sort of gender attached to them. You know, it's a silly example to use beef and chicken, but if I say that to you, you somehow already know which meat is more feminine and which meat is more masculine. Somehow the chicken is a more feminine meat. And we don't believe that. None of us in here believe that. It's absurd, but you already have the vibe, right? Because we're so instilled. Beer and wine, even more obvious. It's so ridiculous to that very deep level. And so, the obvious thing about transgender identity is that this is so much about our sense of self that for some people, when we consider all of those aspects, their sense of self is so at odds with those set of expectations enforced by gender that it confronts them constantly in their lives as an obstacle to self-expression and fulfillment. And that's what we want people to be able to do. But the question is, why? Why is our society so obsessed with policing these aspects? And I think we've all had a point in our lives where we go, what's the big deal? They're not harming anyone, and so on and so on. But actually, there is a reason why these things exist, and it is not biology, and it is not eternity. So, what we find in the historical record is that actually, in the early societies, in the very earliest societies of humanity, men and women were equal. So women's oppression is not an historical, eternal fact. It is something that erodes through a process of social development. And so we have, you know, evidence now that in the earliest societies, women did plenty of hunting, men did plenty of gathering. There was a lot of mixing of those roles that we, from our point of view, have just projected on the idea that there was this strict division. But there was some differences based on, some elements of our biology. So the fact that it's women, just using that term, a shorthand, who give birth and who breastfeed and so on, did make some small differences in those societies about what type of work people would do at various points in their life. But this was neither a very substantial difference, because you were just as likely to divide work according to the age of the person, the ability of the person, the experience of the person, as you were biological or reproductive elements of our difference. And also that this did not mean that these roles were unequal, that actually both these roles were highly valued. And in fact, a lot of the time, the work that might be done more by women was more essential to that society's survival and more respected, as well as that the lineage for families, all sorts of aspects of social relationships were done through the female line. So that's why this is how I like to see what we mean by gender. And if this diagram makes no sense to you, that's on me, not on you, so don't worry. But the starting point for Marxists is to see that all of the ideas and conceptions we have in the world do not fall out of the sky, do not come from a portal in our brain to the netherworld. They are arising from real material things we do in the real world. So gender only exists when there is a division of labour based on sex. And so in a society where that's a minimal division, then the gender differences are less pronounced. But also in a society in which everyone must collaborate, the gender aspect of things is not restrictive and oppressive. So for here we have men and women, there are some differences about what they do in society, and that will not just be in the economic production of life, but then there will be different cultural practices and customs and religious events and so on that go along with that. And all of that then allows us to develop a set of ideas about women's attributes, men's attributes, femininity, masculinity, and so on. And as individuals in those societies, we develop a sense of which of these roles we are more likely to want to adopt to. So it's not just when we say gender's a social construction, it's not just something you can wish away and all of us here go, oh, it's all fake, therefore, you know, we're all liberated now. It's something rooted in our society. But this is early societies where production is about egalitarian collectivity. People are all working together and sharing equally. And that's why we find so many examples around the world everywhere of gender diversity, because there's no reason in these societies to stop people picking the gender identity they like. So, you know, from Chile to Samoa to Mexico, we have ones here of different ones. Some of these are male to female, some are female to male, some are third gender. Because the other thing about seeing the sexual division of labour is that in these early societies, some people were not involved in reproduction. They were involved in being the shamans, the priests, the doctors. And so that, as a role, is a third role in society between the sexual division of labour. So it's a third gender. So, you know, this is how things work. And you can go on. There are so many more. Here now we're in Africa. Here we're in Myanmar. Different gender roles, totally accepted and accepted. Over here we have a drawing from when the colonizers first went to America. And in every tribe they found, there were people called, we call two-spirit people today. So the one here on the right is a male-bodied person who's adopted a female role. Absolutely no dramas. And you find this in every tribe all across America, and generally they're very respected roles. And some of this is quite challenging if you think that transgender identity is just some postmodern phenomenon, because some of the practices in these societies are incredible. For example, in the African Bantu people, when a male-bodied person is initiated at puberty into the female role, they then simulate a number of female reproductive practices. They scratch the inside of their legs during the menstrual period in order to bleed, like women do. At the moment of they give birth, by taking a tonic that simulates a very painful simulation of pregnancy, basically. They're actually passing a bowel movement, but in the process, a child is then given to that person after that process. So there's quite a lot, of diversity here. It isn't just about a third gender role. There's also clearly a sense for people that they want to be accepted totally in the other side, and all of these practices are formed to allow that, which is incredible stuff. But I haven't finished because there's even more, right? So in Albania, all the way up to the 20th century, you've got these people called sworn virgins, and these are female people who just say, I promise not to get pregnant, and they're initiated into the male role. They're given a gun and all the things associated with that. It's not a super liberated role these are, class societies where women's oppression does exist, but the flexibility that's possible in different societies is something we are not used to today. And in Indonesia, there's five genders, top that. and again, you've got, these are the basic equivalents you've got there, cis, male to female, female to male, and still that third gender on top of all that. So we've got so much diversity, and what's really driving that is that in different societies, the economic structure of society is different, and this allows these things through. Now, the other aspect of it is that even when class societies start to emerge, because it's this long process, which I'll talk a little bit about why it leads to the oppression of women, because it's this long process, there's still leading for thousands and thousands of years a lot of those ancient practices which value both genders, which have multiple genders and so on, all of that is still leaking through even in these early class societies where women are definitely oppressed and a lot of cross-gender stuff is outlawed. Not all of it can be. So here we have an example of deities all across the world who are valued for their intersexuality, for the idea that the roles of men and women and the people in between are all very valuable things. And again, even into the ancient class societies, the priest position is still one that is considered neither man nor woman. And it is only with feudalism later that it specifically becomes a role considered male. Okay, so how does class society actually begin the process of oppressing women? Well, with the settlement of people in societies, now there is a premium on women having more children. And so that sexual division of labour deepens. There is now larger differences between the work men and women do because women spend more of their time raising children. They're not the only ones to do it, but, there are aspects, just technical aspects to being pregnant, childbirth, rearing and breastfeeding and so on, that do start to increase that sexual division of labour. But even that's not the part that really creates the inequality. What creates the inequality is that through the development of agriculture, you start to increase the wealth in society. And you increase the wealth in society enough that a layer of people can stop working and have everyone else do the work. And what they do is direct the work. And they're very determined to maintain that control at the top of society and to ensure that their property is, taken down the generations accurately. And so, therefore, women's in the ruling class, women are seen as producers of heirs for these rulers, and that monogamy must be enforced because the patrilineality, the male line must be determined exactly. In the old societies, it's easy to know which kid, is from the mother because it came out of them. But in these societies, unless you enforce monogamy ruthlessly, it's very hard to know who the father is. And the other aspect is even more importantly as things go on, is at the bottom of society, the people who work, they need to produce as many children as they can for the ruling class in order to increase the surplus and the wealth that they're making in society. But this is, as I said, a very long process in history. It's not something that happens overnight. It is a long process in history where it both the rise of the wealthy who control the labour and their control of the sexual reproduction of society and their development of a state of armed people who are going to protect their wealth and so on, all of these processes sort of mixed up And as I said, because what they're coming out of is customs and societies where there are all sorts of gender, cross-gender activities and so on, a lot of these keep leaking in and leaking through for many years. Okay, so in the feudal era, what we see is a developing in Europe. The empires that are emerging in France and, in Britain and, all around Europe, these societies become very obsessed with destroying the local customs of the peasants that they are controlling, because they start to get more integrated. They start to want to have more regular control over all the people in their society, and they have a patriarchal religion that they want to also impose on people as a sign of their ideological commitment to the ruling class in those societies. So actually there's some fascinating things where you find if I can find it, basically in about 390, the Christian council starts to say, we're sick of all this effeminate men stuff and we need to outlaw all of that because it's associated with pagan rituals and so on. But there's a lot more you could say about all of that. The interesting thing, as I said, about how this stuff still lingers on even until the 19th century. So here's an individual, a Chevalier d'Eon, who was a French diplomat. So not a great person, but someone who there was actually a betting pool on the London Stock Exchange what their true sex was. And when he was never ascertained, the king of France officially decreed by document that they were female. So it's for me, reading about this stuff was really quite eye-opening. It's not to say this is a really free and liberating practice, but how different that is to our conception. But basically the Middle Ages are just this particularly savage, brutal time for gender-diverse people and so on, and that in capitalism, there we get the progress and the acceptance and so on. Well, actually, who'd have thought that that someone like this would have been in the royal court based on the conception we have. Another interesting life around this time is that of James Barry, who was one of the chief British military surgeons in the Empire, performed the first caesarean in which both the mother and the child lived in Africa. And they live their entire adult life as a man, and their birth sex is only known at autopsy. So these are things that have been going on for centuries and centuries. And another interesting thing, again, how in the feudal era, this is what they're concerned about in terms of destroying gender diversity, the connection for the peasant, local peasants, of their old customs and the resistance they then take to the ruling class, because these peasants are men dressed as women. This is Rebecca and her sisters in 1839, the original, woke gender fighters, you might say, if you were to see it in that constricting light. These people saw nothing demeaning at all, and actually something empowering about dressing as women and being Rebecca and her daughters in fighting the tollgate system and the tollgate fees in Britain, where basically the new sort of capitalist class are saying, we want you to pay for everything, we're closing the land up, it's going to be bought and sold, we're putting gates everywhere, and every time you pass one, you have to pay. Well, these people thought there was something powerful about holding on to their old traditions. Very, very interesting stuff. Okay. All right, now, so what we see is that we're talking about there's a difference between men and women that creates our sense of differences in our ideas about men and women, the practices we then attribute to that. But in our world, all of that is subordinated to production for the ruling class. So everything we do in our gender has to do with helping to sustain the control of them. So that is what is shaping our understandings and our real division between men and women and the roles they play. And then those help to reinforce, the control of the ruling class in our society. Okay. Now, with the emergence of early capitalism, this is actually when things get extreme, right? You might think it's 1200, someone being burned at the stake, that's the worst time. No, everything gets more extreme with the rise of capitalism. So with the colonial era, the Spanish and the French and the British are going around the world, they're looking for gold, they're looking for slaves, they're trying to accumulate as much wealth as possible because this is the early capitalist phase. This is the competitive phase, the initial phase of building up as much wealth as you can. And they interact with all sorts of societies that they're disgusted by, but they're not just disgusted by them because they have prejudicial attitudes about homosexuality and so on. They're disgusted by them because they're people who refuse to be slaves. They're people who refuse to give up their land. They're people who refuse to adopt the European feudal and new capitalist forms of work. And so not only do they need to be enslaved, but their cultures need to be destroyed. And this cements in the mentality of the new early capitalist class the disgust for everything that is not the new patriarchal roles, male and women, and so on. So, for example, this is what happened to Two-Spirit people when the Spanish went to America. They fed them to the dogs. Actually, by 1861, the British imposed Section 377 of the Penal Code on every colony they had. And that actually still applies in many countries around the world. This is an offence against everything that is not, you know, sex inside marriage and so on. So this, when we, you know, today we talk about the barbaric third world and so on, where LGBT people are treated so poorly and so on. Actually, homosexuality is only illegal in those countries which were colonized. In fact, the Muslim countries who do not have homosexuality on their, for example, on their criminal books are those ones that weren't colonized by the British. So it is very much the prerogative of these people. So that's the colonial phase. But more important for us is the industrial phase of capitalism in the 19th century, because what's happening in the heart of capitalism in Britain and later in the rest of Europe is the Industrial Revolution. So all of those old peasant family societies are now being broken up. People are being driven off the land because they need to go into the cities. They need to produce wealth in the factories of Britain. They're getting churned up and churned out through this process. This is the Industrial Revolution. Look at the absolute chaos going on. Where do people eat? Where do people sleep? You know, people are in factories for 13, 14, 16 hours a day. Little kids, 5 years, 4 years old in this doing this stuff. They're dying at 17. That's the average age of life expectancy in Manchester, for example. The whole world's being chewed up in pollution of the air, the land, the water. So there's sickness. There's general organ, like there's general chaos and crime in the streets. There's things like prostitution, orphans, and so on. All of this stuff is rife. So this is not a sustainable state of affairs for the capitalist class in Britain, and nor would it be for any other society, or any other capitalist society in Europe. So at first they don't give a shit. They're just about, we'll get more peasants, get more peasants. And you realise that's not how things work. You remember about the birds and the bees. So you've got to make more people, and you've got to have some sense of stability, because the last picture you see here is a massively rising workers' movement in Britain that is determined to tear the head off the capitalist class, that says the French Revolution didn't give us what we were after, equality, liberty, fraternity, and we're going to go the rest of the way. So with all this chaos and instability, and over the decades of the 19th century, there must be applied a new model and a new form of stabilizing sexual and family relations. And so this is when you see, for example, a number of changes. The Factories Act of 1844, which limits the working hours of women and children, because they're being, you know, destroyed and eaten up. And even for men. And then the introduction of the family wage, which is supposed to be an increase for male workers in order to cover the work, in order to cover the living expenses of women and children who they are now trying more to discourage, especially married women and young children from being in the factories and being destroyed, because they need a healthy, reliable and ongoing workforce. Okay. And that's what we see here, is that the nuclear family, again, if the diagram doesn't make sense, Just close your eyes. So what we have in the black is the economic system that's developing. And what we have inside is the utility of the nuclear family in many different ways. What the nuclear family does is it allows the supply of labor power, which is the most valuable commodity for capitalists, the workers. If they didn't have them, you'd have to do it yourself. Jesus, that'd be awful, wouldn't it? Having to work yourself for your life. So you need a supply of them, and what a better way than to get them to do it all for free? Because you think about it, it's weird in our society, right? You're doing all this work at work, and then you go home and you think you can relax, but then you've got fucking dishes to wash, you've got meals to cook, you've got kids to look after, you've got sick people to look after, you've got to make your bed, you've got to drive to whatever. You know, like, why do we do all that stuff for free? How come that's not a job like anything else, you know? And that's because it saves a hell of a lot of money for the capitalist class to make that happen inside a nuclear family. And, of course, that's where women's oppression is reinforced in capitalism because, of course, who's going to do all that free labour? That's the women's job. It also provides stability in a society that's a market society. Some days you've got work, you go to the work, next day the market's thrown everything up, there's no work anymore in that factory. Now, before the family, people just go wandering around Britain looking for more work, looking for better wages and so on. They don't want that to happen. They want people to be kept in their place for when they need them again for the next round of production. It's an important aspect of discipline because in the factory, you know, instead of going on strike for your wages, you think, oh, shit, if I do that, then my kids and my dependents will have nothing. So, again, the privatisation of the responsibility of the development of this. And the socialisation aspect in that when kids are brought up, they're taught all of these things about how to respect authority, how to do what your parents tell you. Then you go to school and you get told to respect them and do everything they say and do not talk back and do not question and so on. And so all of those things are connected to different aspects of the economy and production that all of these people just exist basically as slaves to do. And look. Look at the similarity in our world of the family system, the locked up little private individual units of residence and so on that we have, and the barracks, you know, down there on the right. It's like basically you have a system that's about like controlling and owning people's labour. So what do they do at the times they're not at work? Then you send them back home. You know, in an army, they don't say, oh, you know, your drill's over, off you go, have fun. You know, please come back tomorrow or whatever. They control everyone and everything they do. Now, in our society, you've got a little bit more freedom than you would have as a slave, of course. You're free to choose the house you live in, you know, if you can afford it, what food you buy and so on. But you're not free to break out of the model of work, home, work, home. So this is an important way of sustaining these things. Now, how does gender diversity go into that? Well, think about it. It's shit. Right? This is shit. If you're living in a new city, you want to be free. You want to explore all the different things. You want to create new communities. If you're same-sex attracted, you want to have those kind of relationships instead. But that would cause disorder and low morale in the workplace. And so what you see at the same time is the repression, the criminalization, and the pathologization throughout this process of LGBT, what we call now LGBT people. So you famously have the trial of Oscar Wilde and, you know, over here, moral lepers of London, you know, will be punished, basically. And, you know, now, because it's a free city where, unlike in a peasant society, you know, you'd be lucky to have a fleeting interaction with someone from a village like 10 miles away. You'd be fleeting, lucky to have a fleeting same-sex interaction there. Well, in a city, you've got a little bit more freedom or anonymity to go and do that. So you need even more overwhelming social prejudice, overwhelming institutional repression of people's sexual proclivities and gender proclivities. So this is when you see the raids on the molly houses, which are cross-dressing pubs and so on in this society. In 1860s in America, they bring in laws outlawing cross-dressing, which suggests a lot of it is going on and so on. All right. Now, the thing is, though, you know, they can't totally control it all. And that's where we start to see how the workers' movement that emerges takes up the mantle of and allows the space for a gay community to emerge. And especially when we're looking at Germany and America and Russia, and especially after the revolution in Russia. So there is a gay community forms in the cracks, you know, in the secret places. But actually, especially in Germany, where there's a large workers' movement that's fighting for democratic rights, there is even more space. Look at this interesting thing from 1910. This is it's not that progressive from today's point of view, but this is a certificate, a license for this person to wear male clothing. And again, you wouldn't think that something like this would occur if you just have this vision that everything's better and better now than it's ever been, and you go back and everything just gets worse in a sort of gradient. Okay. And in particular, an interesting study is done by this guy over on the right with the big old mustache. That's Magnus Hirschfeld. And he had an Institute for Sexual Science in Germany. And he, in 1910 as well, wrote this magnificent study of people who cross-dress, or transgender people we'd call today. And he has very forward-thinking views about all of this. Basically, none of us are really male or female. And, you know, people today complain that there's three or five genders or whatever. He postulates there's something between 81 and 43 million genders. So take that. All right. And, for example, in his institute was the first vaginoplasty performed on Lily Elba, or there was one person before her, but she was more famous around 1930. And actually, in the Russian Revolution, many of the leading revolutionaries were sent to this Institute for Sexual Science to figure out, what's human sexuality all about? Because our society is so repressive, we don't know. And there they learned about the diversity of sex and gender practices. Okay. But obviously, what happens? Well, the middle of the 20th century is actually the worst time in human history to be LGBT. So it's not 1200s. It's not, you know, ancient Rome. It's the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. This is the worst time. You've got Marxism. You've got Stalinism. You've got McCarthyism in America. So here we have, which is one of the first things the Nazis did, that book burner you all know about. It was books from the Institute of Sexual Science. And what were the Nazis about? Reimposing capitalism, imperialism in Germany, because there was a rising and near-revolutionary workers' movement. Okay. And looking in America, we have the second wave of the development of the gay and trans community. You have the Stonewall, which we'll mention in a bit, but you also have a number of ones that lead up to it. You have, in 1959, you have a riot at Cooper's Donuts. 66, you've got one at Compton's Cafeteria. This one's great. It started with a police officer coming in to harass transgender women, drag queens and so on. They throw a cup of coffee in his face and start, you know, a mass riot like that. In the last one there, Pickets of Black Cat, actually, this got a lot of support from the black community. Again, people maligned as, like, more homophobic and stuff. That's actually wrong. Historically, black community have been more supportive of LGBT people, just a racist and classist stereotype from the capitalists. All right, and then you've got the 1969 Stonewall riot. And what we've learned in the last few years, obviously, is the amazing role that transgender people and gender non-conforming people played at the forefront of this. You know, the person who reportedly sparked it, Stormy DeLavery, in our terms, maybe a trans male, you know, is getting pulled into the police van and just yells out, "You've all got to do something!" And it starts. It starts like that, right? And also we have, of course, two more famous participants, Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, people who consider themselves revolutionaries and who went on to play leading roles in the gay liberation movement. And so the gay liberation movement really has the radicalism at the time of the anti-Vietnam War movement, the civil rights movement, the growing workers' movement. And so they actually see that gay oppression, which at the time meant all of this stuff, was caused by capitalism, and they were for overthrowing capitalism. But unfortunately, we had, you know, the moderation of those movements as the struggle declined. People set their horizons lower and they thought, we just need to be accepted and integrated into society. And so there was the development instead of more moderate gay reform and gay rights movement rather than gay liberation. And because of that, a lot of them backtracked from supporting the more flaming queens and drag queens and transgender expression and so on, because it's more confronting to mainstream society. Now, the other aspect I want to quickly touch on is how transgender medicine starts to emerge and become standardized through this process. Now, obviously, the people who do it have some good intentions, but actually the effect they have is by narrowing the definition of transgender to very restrictive terms. And basically, they're trying to get people... They will only help people who they think will pass undetected, stealthily, throughout their whole lives. You go, you get the surgery, you move to another place, you never talk to anyone again. And so they create a definition of transsexual that actually restricts this heavily. And what people do around the community is they get the script that they know they have to say, they memorize it, they go in, dress, jewelry, everything, make sure there's not a single thing, you know, they play up the stereotypes and so on, and they say what they know the institutes want to hear. And that is, thankfully, I think, and quite positively being challenged today. Over the last 10 years, as there's been more acceptance that what is trans is a much broader phenomenon today. And here's some people who were part of that generation. Again, they played positive roles, but there was a sense that you have to basically be undetectable and so on. Okay. And here's the sense of the moderateness of the gay rights movement as it goes on. Yeah, here are some of the sponsors on the right of the gay rights movement. Thanks very much, Apple. Thanks so much, Intel and Lyft. Yeah, I always see you there. By Google as well. Who could forget Google? Thanks so much. These people who just exploit and ruin our lives then want to pretend they're on our side. And that's the interesting thing about this period from the gay liberation movement till today, is that capitalism is flexible. You know, it can allow a little bit of a shift in the family structure because the basic function remains the same. The basic function is you have people who are privately responsible for raising children, for looking after themselves, and that does at no cost to the capitalist class. And it doesn't really affect things like the gender pay gap and structural aspects of oppression to be able to incorporate a few more of those people into the family structure. And it can especially happen because a century of forcing people into those units has made it quite a sort of, it just sort of is replicated by inertia and so on, whereas at the start there had to be a lot more punitive things of forcing people into those structures because they weren't natural at the time. Now we see them as natural. We tend to just then, and you don't really have a choice, you go and get your own apartment, you get your own so on and so on. So within that, we have fought, and it's been our fight to get those things, but it is, capitalism in some places can open the space a little bit for that. And, you know, this is why the identity politics way of thinking about things is wrong, because the identity politics way of thinking about things is the problem is there aren't enough trans people in the media, on the representation and so on. If there are, things are going to get better for transgender people. So the Human Rights Campaign celebrate the new Secretary of Health for Joe Biden, who refuses to lock down in America despite 600,000 COVID deaths, who refuses universal fucking healthcare, and we're supposed to be celebrating representation in a vicious capitalist imperialist government. That's not liberation. And, you know, on a less harmful basis, but still quite superficial basis, you know, a celebrity culture around trans representation and visibility and so on, you know, not quite as pernicious, but, you know, creating complacency almost about what we actually need to liberate trans people, because trans people have to eat. So what good is it that you see yourself on a Time magazine cover if you haven't got the money to buy the bloody magazine, if you haven't got the, you know, you haven't got the time to read it because you're working 12 hours a day. I mean, there's better things to read, but, you know, I'm just trying to go with the metaphor here, right? So, and so who is really our idol should be people like Chelsea Manning, okay? Yeah. A transgender person. No surprises here, in my opinion, that someone who is willing to go up against the American war machine to release the filth that they do around the world is someone who's also got the guts in prison to stand up and say who they really are. And that's our idol there, is people like Chelsea Manning. And I think the other problem with the identity politics today is a lot of them can be more critical of the, you know, getting people up at the very, very top of society and the pink dollar and the Google and so on, but they still have totally insufficient, strategies and ways of thinking about how we're going to change it. So some of them think what we do is we need to deliberately provoke, by dressing up in ways that deliberately challenge the gender stereotypes. And if you want to do that, fucking be my guest. I do it all the time. But that's just who I am. I don't see that as a political statement. And I think that's not... If you go think about that diagram I had before, that's not where the change comes from. You don't go from the gender values, you try and change those, and that's going to change the material conditions at the bottom that are reinforcing it. You've got to change the material conditions. Why do we need nuclear families? Because we're all still fucking wage slaves for the capitalist class who need to regulate and order every aspect of our lives. That's why, and the other thing I don't like about identity politics is all of the very hyper-woke moral elitism that's going on, where the problem is apparently, white, cis-het, male, blah, workers, who actually are on our side. Because it's the people who most support capitalism, most support the exploitation and inequality in our society, who are the ones viciously enforcing transphobia. That's not a coincidence. And actually, throughout history, we see it is workers who aren't just hard hat men, but even those guys who are actually much more likely to be on our side. So just to wrap up, the Marxist strategy is to see that unless we get rid of capitalism, we might be able to get legal equality. We might be able to get every law that's got something specifically about trans people or whatever. We might be able to get those off the books. It's fucking looking like they're trying to put them all back on the books anyway. So that point, you can forget that point, basically. But even if that were true, what use is that if you can't eat, if you've got to spend your whole life working? And it's not just trans people who are restrained and repressed by gender oppression. It's women, so half the bloody population. But I think in general, all of us, our identities get constructed in a process of values that are enforced on us. And obviously we want to be able to express that, even if it's not, what a complete human can do, but a complete human will be able to express themselves without even needing these restrictive lenses. That's what we should be aiming for. And for that, we need revolution. Because if we were to overthrow capitalism, then we would not need the nuclear family anymore. Children would be raised socially because women are not going to just fucking overthrow capitalism and then be like, oh, back to go do the dishes. Like, they're going to be like, can we sort this fucking thing out where I have to do the dishes all the time? It's going to become a social job that anyone has to do. It's going to be child raising is going to be, because for both the child and the parents, it sucks. The children only got two people to choose from to relate to in their lives and obey and be guided by and so on. And the people and the parents, have basically no freedom. Ask any parent, especially one with a child under the age of three, just how, devastating and exhausting this is. So if you got rid of that, where's the reproducing of gender roles in the family? Because all people are doing this stuff. So where's the difference in the economy and in our material practice between men and women? And the other thing is, I think it's even cooler than when we look back at the pre-class societies and stuff, where there's still some constraints on all of this because, you can't always control when you get pregnant and having kids and so on. We can do even better now with all the technology we have, that I think even into the future, the sky's the limit about how people are going to use their bodies, their sexualities, the act of reproduction and so on in ways that even at that biological level we can, which we already have with things like the pill and so on and trans hormones and all that stuff, even at that level we can challenge the idea that people are determined in any way by their biology, but we'll get to choose their biology to have control over that aspect. But at the social and economic level, where will the difference be? And, people should talk about how we get that revolution and so on. But in the meantime, it's things like this that we have to keep out there fighting and so on. So I will just end quickly with this quote, or I'll just go at the very last paragraphs from this great writer. As trans people, we will not be free until we fight for and win a society in which no class stands to benefit from fomenting hatred and prejudice, where laws restricting sex and gender and human love will be unthinkable, not there, but unthinkable. Look for us, transgender warriors, in the leadership of the struggle to usher in the dawn of liberation. Thank you.